Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Ventura County is famous for its beautiful weather and its pristine coastline, not its grisly murders. That all changed on the night of May 20th, 2009, when three members of a wealthy Ventura County family were slaughtered inside their luxurious beachfront home. The father was a successful businessman. The pregnant mother was a former beauty queen. Their unborn son was waiting to take his first breath of life. For nearly a year, detectives were unable to solve the bizarre beach house slayings. Finally, in the spring of 2010, a DNA database broke the case wide open. Filled with stirring interviews, historic context, and never-before-released details about the Faria murders, Black Knight, Gold Coast tells the story of an American tragedy that is at once shocking, timely, and haunting. The book that we're featuring this evening is Black Knight, Gold Coast, with my special guest, journalist and author, Gray George. Welcome to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Gray George.
Good evening. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you very much. Interesting, very interesting book, to say the least. Let's talk about, set the stage with, you explain a little bit about Ventura County, and for those people that don't know, which probably most people, tell us about the breakdown with the smaller cities of Ventura and Oxnard and Thousand Oaks and Simi Valley, and then talk about Ventura itself. So tell us a little bit about this beautiful, tranquil place before we talk about Brock and Davina Husteds.
Ventura County is just northeast of Los Angeles, just northwest of Los Angeles. It hugs the Pacific coast, and it's known for several things. As you read at the beginning, it's known for its beautiful coastline, its nearly perfect year-round weather. And the county is, believe it or not, largely agricultural. There are several larger cities in the county, though, and that's where most of the population is based. The largest city is Oxnard, and then there are at least three other cities I know of in the county that have populations that exceed 100,000, those being Thousand Oaks, Simi Valley, and the city of Ventura itself, which is the county seat. Ventura County, unlike Los Angeles, Ventura County is known for low crime rates, for affluent citizens, for people who essentially want to get away from the crime of the larger cities and the bigger metropolitan areas. So when it comes to crime, typically people, at least in this region, don't think of Ventura County as being a hotbed of violent, sensational crime.
Now let's talk about a couple people that are very central to this case, of course, and we talked about the husband and the pregnant wife and in this beautiful home on this beachfront. Let's talk about Brock Edward, and if I mispronounce the name, please correct me, Husted, and Davona Husted, okay, and Davona and the former Deboni. So tell us about this couple that's both 42 years of age when this story begins, when we are looking at this couple. Tell us about them and their children, and tell us a little bit about what they do and who they really are, and especially in this community.
Brock and Davina Husted were a very affluent couple. They lived in a community at the time of their murders called Faria, which is just a few miles up the coast from the city of Ventura. Faria is an extremely upscale community. Only a few people live there in several oceanfront homes. Brock Husted was born in Hidden Hills, which is a community in Los Angeles County that is one of the most affluent in the entire country. As I point out in the book, Bloomberg Business listed in 2009, the year of this crime, listed Hidden Hills as being one of the wealthiest towns in America. So Brock Husted grew up in relative affluence. When he was a child, his family moved to a city called Moorpark, which is in Ventura County. And for high school, he attended a very exclusive private school in Ojai called Villanova Preparatory Academy. After high school, Brock's brother Scott went to work at a local bank. And while he was working at the bank, he met a young woman who was one of his coworkers named Davina DeBoni. She was a tall, statuesque blonde, absolutely gorgeous. In fact, when she was 19 years old, she had won the Miss Oxnard pageant, and then she'd gone on to compete in the Miss California pageant, which I'm sure most of your audience members know is the last step before one enters the Miss America pageant. So Davina DeBoni was absolutely gorgeous, and at least it's my understanding that when Scott Husted first met her, he thought that she might be a good match for his younger brother, Brock. So to make a long story short, in 1990, Brock and Davina Husted were introduced to one another. And as the story goes, there were immediate sparks between them. Within the next couple of years, they were engaged. And finally, in 1995, they married. They initially lived after their marriage in a very exclusive neighborhood in the city of Ventura called Ventura Keys, which is nestled right along the coast. There are mooring areas, there are boat docks within the neighborhood. And then after their children were born, they moved up the coast to the Faria home. At the time of the crimes, Brock Husted operated a business called Couture Concepts. He provided custom metalwork for high-end clients. Some of his celebrity clients here in this region included Suzanne Somers, Mel Gibson, Oprah Winfrey, who owns a large spread up in the Montecito area of Santa Barbara County. He had done work for all of them. Brock Husted's work, his metal work, had appeared in magazines. And at the same time that Brock Husted was getting his metal business up and running, Davina was establishing herself as a major player in the local charity world of Ventura County. She was the president of the National Charity Junior League of Ventura. She made enormous strides in terms of fundraising for that particular charity as well as others. And in fact, 1 week before the tragic crimes that I detail in the book, she had given a check for almost $85,000 to the local hospital. So both Brock and Davina Husted were enormously active people. They were involved in their community. They were deeply involved in the lives of their children, Brocky and Isabella. And from all outward appearances, they had almost the perfect life living in their beautiful multi-million dollar oceanfront home in Faria.
Now, tell us a little bit about the ages. Tell us the ages of the two children, Brocky, the boy, and Isabella, the girl. And just tell us a little bit about the children that they had. Now, you talked about the idyllic life that they must have had, but tell us just a little bit about the characters of these two children at that age, 9 and 11.
At the time of the crimes, Isabella was 11 years old. Brocky was 9 years old. It's my understanding that they attended Pierpoint Elementary School in Ventura. Brocky and Isabella were extremely close based on everything I've been able to glean about this case. And they were very close with their parents. When they weren't in school, they took cotillion classes, which it's my understanding those are manners-based classes. They also spent a lot of time with their family members, with their father, out fishing, surfing, boating. Their mother was actively involved at their school where she was involved in volunteer work. And from all accounts, they were completely normal, well-adjusted children who came from a very large Ventura County background. Like I pointed out before, both of their parents had grown up in Ventura County, so they had a large network of family members who lived nearby, and they were very well supported, fortunately, after the tragedy occurred.
Now, this idyllic life is obviously shattered May 20th, 2009, but you do mention, you talk about their comfort, their affluence, I guess their relative security living in this gated community. So what was their practice in terms of security with this house? What was their real day-to-day practice? And also tell us, set the stage for what they were doing as a family that evening on May 20th, 2009.
So, unfortunately, and it's one of the great ironies of this story, I think, the Husteds, because I think they lived in a very safe, comfortable, gated community, they took their security, their home security, for granted a little bit, at least on the night of the tragedy. On the night of the murders, the family was sitting in their living room at their beachfront property, and they were watching television. They were watching American Idol, and that was the season finale, actually, on May 20th, 2009, of the season when Chris Allen and Adam Lambert squared off on American Idol. Well, at about 10 p.m., the winner of American Idol was announced, and at the time, Brocky, his mother Davina, and his father Brock were sitting in the living room of their home. Isabella was asleep in her bedroom toward the front end, the north end of their home. And it was just a very normal, typical night for them. Just after the winner was announced, just after Chris Allen was announced as the victor in that year's American Idol, Brock Husted rose off the couch and he walked into the kitchen of their home, which was attached to the living room area is sort of one large great room. Now, as I mentioned before, it appears that the Husteds were, at least on this evening, somewhat lax about their home security, and both the back door and the side door of their home had been left unlocked. So as Brock Husted was walking around the kitchen and his wife and his young son Brocky were sitting in the living room watching the confetti fall on the stage at the Nokia Theater in Hollywood, a man bursts through the back door of their home, and it was from there that the tragic events of May 20th really began to take shape.
Now, where was Isabella at this time? And he burst through, and so what was, number one, everybody saw him, but we're going to be talking about there was only really one witness. So tell us what this intruder looked like and how he was dressed and if he was armed or not.
So at the time, Brocky and his mother were sitting on the sofa in their living room. His father Brock was in the kitchen area. His sister Isabella was asleep in her bedroom at the front of the house. The intruder who burst through the door was dressed head to toe in black. He was wearing black boots, a black jumpsuit, black gloves, and a black motorcycle helmet that completely covered his face. As soon as he charged through the door, according to the statement that was later given to detectives, he immediately told all of the family members, Brock, Davina, and Brocky, to get on the floor. They did as they were instructed. They all immediately got on the floor. And as soon as they were down, the intruder, who was holding what appeared to be a black semi-automatic pistol, got on Brock Husted's back and immediately pointed his gun at the back of the father's head and began demanding money from the family. It was impossible for the three members of the family who saw the suspect enter the home to get a clear view of his face because there was a visor on the face mask that actually obscured the portion of the face that would otherwise be visible. So all they knew is that this armed, violent individual had entered their home. He had ordered them to the floor. He had jumped on the father's back. He had grabbed the father's hair in his hands, smashed the father's face into the floor, leaving a puddle of blood on the wooden kitchen floor, and he had started demanding the family's money from them. We can only imagine it must have been an absolutely terrifying experience.
Now, how pregnant was Davina, and what was her state? What was her reaction to this intruder? How hysterical was she or not?
It appears that she maintained an extremely level head. I think I forgot to mention that she was 5 months pregnant when all of this occurred. She was 5 months pregnant with her third child. Based on the crime scene photos I was able to observe during my research for the book, she was clearly pregnant. Her abdomen was very convex. So we know with absolute certainty that the suspect must have known that she was pregnant at the time of the crimes. She apparently kept an extremely level head during the crime, as did her husband, as did Brocky, the son, who was 9 years old at the time and witnessing all of this inside of his home. And as soon as the intruder began making demands for money, Davina instructed her son in what was reported as a calm voice, or at least as calm as one could reasonably expect for a situation like this. She instructed her son to go back to the bedroom and get the money from her purse. And at almost exactly the same time, the father, who again is being pinned to the floor of the kitchen by the intruder, asked his son to go into the kitchen and, or asked his son to go into the bedroom and get his money clip as well. So as soon as Brocky was instructed to go get his parents' money, he got off the floor, walked into the bedroom, retrieved the money, and brought it back into the main room to give to the intruder.
Brocky heard something very profound uttered from his father or his mother or both regarding him and his sister. What did he hear his parents say?
That's absolutely right. After Brocky gave the money to the intruder, he went back into the living room area where his mother was still on the floor. And it was at about that time that the intruder started demanding jewelry. Well, apparently, I guess assuming that her son didn't know where her jewelry was, Davina Husted struggled up from the floor. And again, she was 5 months pregnant at the time, so we can only imagine it must have been quite an ordeal for her to elevate herself to her feet. She got up off the floor and attempted to go get jewelry for the intruder. Well, at this point, Brocky is standing over in the living room area, and his perception of the event starts to break down a little bit. Of course, he's a traumatized 9-year-old boy, so I suppose that's to be expected. But he hears both of his parents begging the intruder not to murder their children. And it was at about this time that his mother and father were both herded out of the kitchen area and into the back bedroom of the home.
Now, what could Brocky hear? And not that he could tell everything that went on, but from his discernment, what could he did conclusively be able to tell that was going on, at least in his mind, from the noises that he heard?
There was slamming, there was banging, there was thrashing coming from the back bedroom where his parents had been herded with the intruder. There's no report that he was able to hear muffled voices, but of course there was a short hallway between Brocky's location in the living room and the back bedroom where his parents had been herded by this armed intruder. After about 3 minutes, after the initial thrashing and banging in the back bedroom, Brocky hears this blood-curdling scream coming from his mother in the back bedroom. And after just a couple of seconds, the screaming stopped. And it was at that point that Brocky finally scampers from where he had been kneeling, standing next to the living room coffee table, to a position behind the far end of the living room sofa, where he was at least partially concealed from anyone who might be looking for him. And after he heard his mother scream, he didn't hear anything else until he started to hear the heavy fall of boots walking through his house.
Now, what he did see, though, was a gun outside of the bedroom. And then he thought, and then he heard those footsteps back in the building again. If I'm not getting events correctly, he did see something happen in terms of the gun, and then something else happened regarding the gun. So tell us what he did see and then that turn of events.
Right, that's more or less correct. So as Brocky is hiding behind the far end of the living room sofa, he hears footsteps coming down the hall. Obviously, the intruder's heavy footsteps coming down the hallway. He sees the intruder still in his motorcycle helmet, still in his black jumpsuit, walk through the living room of his house and move to the back door. Now, this is the door that opens onto the oceanfront deck above the Pacific. It's the same door that the intruder had burst through just minutes earlier. Brocky notices that the intruder is rubbing together the thumb and fingers of his right hand. Brocky didn't think too much of it at the time, but he did recall that detail later. After the intruder walks out the door, Brocky immediately sprints back down the hallway of his home. And as he's going down the hallway, he notices the intruder's what appears to be a black stainless 9mm semi-automatic pistol lying on the floor of the hallway. Well, Brocky walks into his parents' room, and it's an absolute slaughter. His parents are both on the floor. Neither of them are moving. There's no sign of respiration. There's blood everywhere. There's blood on the ceiling. There's blood on the walls. There's a huge puddle of bright red blood on the floor. So fearing for his sister's safety, Brocky immediately makes his way back to his sister Isabella's room, which is beside his parents' bedroom. He walks in, and fortunately he finds that she has not been murdered as well. He wakes Isabella up, and at first, as you can imagine, she's in absolute disbelief. Here's an 11-year-old girl who one minute she's sound asleep in her own bed, the next moment she's being shaken awake by her brother, who is telling her that both of their parents have been eviscerated in their bedroom. Well, at first, Isabella encourages Brocky to get into bed with her, to calm down, everything will be okay, you were just having a bad dream. But after a minute or two, Isabella begins to realize that Brocky is deeply distraught. So she finally relents and gets out of bed and follows him into their parents' bedroom. And that's when she sees the carnage for herself. And that's when both children's terror is ratcheted up to an entirely new level. After Isabella and Brocky view their parents dead, she immediately grabs him by the hand and pulls him into the bathroom. She closes the door. They lock the door. And as they're standing there, shivering, shaking on the bathroom floor, they hear the pounding of footsteps re-entering the home. And both children were absolutely frightened. They immediately took refuge in the shower. They closed the door as silently as they could, and they sat there in the cold, dark bathroom with only a flimsy knob lock on the door between them and the intruder who had re-entered the home.
And to their surprise, he doesn't come looking for them, and what happens?
That is one of the most miraculous parts of this whole story. As they're sitting in there, as the children are sitting in the shower, shivering, having just seen both of their parents brutally slaughtered on the floor of their bedroom, they can hear the intruder walking around the bedroom. They can't tell exactly how he's moving. It sounds like he's moving in sort of an erratic manner, as if he's looking for something in the bedroom. Well, after a few minutes of pounding footsteps, minutes that must have seemed like hours to these poor children, they finally hear the footsteps getting softer and softer and softer as they move away from the bedroom. So, unsure exactly what to do, the children finally decide that they need to call 911, that they need to summon help. So the children exit the shower, they ease the bathroom door open, they look out, and they can't tell that anyone's in the house. Brocky looks out into the hallway, and he notices two really important details. He notices, A, that the back door to the house, the door to the oceanfront deck that the intruder had come through, is standing wide open. He also notices that the handgun, what appeared to be a 9mm handgun that was on the floor of the hallway just a few moments earlier when he and Isabella had entered the bedroom, is now gone. So since the children are confident that there's no one in the bedroom, they immediately lock the bedroom door to the hallway and they begin looking at their parents. They finally determine that both of their parents are, in fact, deceased. So Brocky attempts to retrieve the phone. The cordless phone in the bedroom had been knocked to the floor. he and Isabella look over in the corner of the room and they can see their father's outstretched hand. And this is obvious in the crime scene photos as well. Their father's outstretched hand was sort of pointed toward the bed. And evidently the cordless phone was just beyond his reach. So Brocky has to walk through the pool of blood, the huge pool of blood around his mother's body. He has to get up on their bed and he has to sort of crawl across the bed in order to retrieve the phone in the corner of the room. And as he goes across the bed, and it's really a chilling detail of the story that you can see in the crime scene photos, you can see his little bloody footprints on this pure snow white comforter the parents had on their bed. He retrieves the phone. He can't get a dial tone on it. So he and Isabella decide, we have to get out of the house. We need to get help. The phone isn't working. This all seems like a nightmare come to life. So the children re-enter the bathroom. They lock the door behind them. And then by getting on top of the toilet, they're able to slide the bathroom window open, wriggle through the window, and run from the home.
So now police are involved. The neighbor calls 911, and so we have the police involved. What do police find in terms of how they were killed and how many times they were stabbed? Tell us about those kinds of details and what the police can surmise with just initially from looking at this crime scene and what they do surmise from just looking at that crime scene.
As soon as Ventura County Sheriff's deputies made it to the home, they immediately rushed through the house, and they saw signs of a struggle everywhere they looked. There was blood behind the island in the kitchen, which is where the intruder had smashed Brock Husted's face into the floor after he had initially made entry into the home. There were also two women's shirts, one of which was on top of the kitchen island. The other was was in the hallway of the home beside the spilled contents of a Louis Vuitton purse. So the deputies make their way down the hallway of the home. They find the bedroom door locked. It was still locked from where Isabella and Brocky had locked it when they were attempting to retrieve the cordless phone. The deputies kick down the door to the bedroom. They enter the bedroom and they find the parents slaughtered. They can obviously tell that the parents had were victims of a violent homicide. And so they immediately call detectives who come out to the crime scene and begin assessing the elements of it. Now, in the course of investigating the crime, it should be pointed out that, as I'm sure most of your listeners know, most murders are predicated on fairly conventional motives like anger, jealousy, revenge, that sort of thing. These crimes were unusual, not only in the sense that they happened in this very low crime, upscale, gated community, but also because there appeared to be absolutely no motive to the crime. The detectives looked into Brock and Davina Husted's backgrounds early on, and they couldn't find any links to known criminals, to any kind of problems in their background that might point at a suspect in the case. So the upshot was they had no leads in the case. Now, if we look at the evidence in the bedroom in retrospect, I think that there are some reasonable conclusions that we can draw. For example, the murders were not the result of a highly planned crime by some skilled master criminal. These were very impulsive murders. These were opportunistic murders. These were murders that were committed by a disorganized individual who had no understanding of how evidence works. Just as an example of that, the murder weapon, which was a huge butcher knife that had been taken from the cutlery block in the Husted's kitchen, it had been left at the crime scene. So not only had the murderer in this case left the butcher knife he'd used to murder the victims lying on the floor behind them, literally with their blood and flesh all over it, he'd also left a living witness to the crime. I should also point out that when the detectives initially entered the bedroom, they saw blood droplets leading from the victims into the master bathroom, and they noticed that the same blood droplets were around the kitchen, bathroom sink area. So the detectives started to surmise that somehow in the commission of the crimes, the offender's hand had gotten slippery with the blood of his victims. It had slipped off the knife. He had cut himself on the knife's blade, and then he had rushed into the bathroom to wash his hands. And as it turns out, that conjecture turned out to be right on the money.
The other thing that we didn't mention was that there's a sexual component to this, and I will ask if police were sidetracked by that even for a moment or at all. But the wife's top was off, and then they did find a green hand towel in the washroom that had semen and some other blood as well. So tell us about the state of her, and also tell us about how many stab wounds between the two.
There were more than 60 stab wounds inflicted on the victims. Brock Husted was stabbed no less than 25 times, mostly in the abdomen. Davina Husted was stabbed nearly 50 times, and her stab wounds ranged from her abdomen to her neck to her throat to her head. They were grisly wounds. One of the stab wounds went through her ear. Another stab wound went through her cheek and actually opened up a really sickening gash inside her mouth. Other stab wounds were delivered to her neck area. Now, you're right. There was a definite sexual component to this crime, and the detectives were sensitive to that as soon as they walked into the bedroom that night. Davina Husted, prior to the murder, she'd been sitting in her living room, and she'd been wearing sort of two layers of tank tops. And as I pointed out before, those tank tops had been left on the kitchen island and in the hallway of the home. Well, when detectives entered the bedroom, they noticed that she was totally topless, which of course revealed her pregnancy in very obvious detail. And so when Davina and Brock Husted were removed from the home and taken to the county morgue, they were swabbed, as homicide victims usually are in the course of autopsies. And the medical examiner found a quantity of semen inside Davina Husted's mouth, which sealed the deal on the fact that she had been sexually assaulted in the commission of the tragic murders. And as far as the towel is concerned, when detectives entered the bedroom, they noticed that there was a towel that had been left on Davina Husted's shoulder. So if you can imagine, Brock Husted is dead flat on his back in the corner of the bedroom. His hand is stretched out to the right toward his bed. His wife was literally slaughtered right on top of him. In crime scene photos, you can tell that she had fallen on her left side so that her torso was basically covering her husband's outstretched right foot. Well, in leaving the home, it appears that the murderer in this case had dried his hands after he'd cut himself on the knife while stabbing Davina Husted. And he'd also dried himself after committing his sexual assault. So when detectives found this green hand towel on Davina Husted's back, they found not only her blood in significant quantities, they also found the unknown offender's blood in significant quantities and semen down along the bottom fringe of the towel. And so that provided some extremely incriminating forensic evidence for detectives to work with.
Now, with that forensic evidence, they have CODIS, and so they were anxious to see what could happen in putting it into CODIS. What happened when they first put it into CODIS?
When the detectives sent the DNA samples to the California Department of Justice and those DNA samples were entered into CODIS, there was no hit in the system. And it should be pointed out that since 2009, California has expanded its forensic database to the third largest in the world. It's a very comprehensive database at this point. And at the time, there were a lot of reference samples in it of known felons, convicted sex offenders, and so forth. But when the forensic sample from the Faria murders was sent to the California Department of Justice lab, it did not register a quote-unquote hit in the system.
Now, how do police proceed with this? Because as you mentioned briefly, it didn't look like there was any leads in terms of the lifestyle that both of these people led, these exemplary lives and very low risk lifestyles that would not invite anything like this. So how do police proceed after this very mysterious, high profile and fear-inducing murder in this very tranquil community?
And you're absolutely right. These crimes did strike fear in the hearts of community members. People were restless. They were on edge. They were terrified. They were barricading their homes in the aftermath of this crime. Detectives in cases like this go out, they canvass the neighborhood. They look for anyone in the area who might not have belonged there. They look for suspicious persons reports. They look for prowler reports. They look into the victim's backgrounds to determine whether or not there could be any connection between victim and killer. And I should point out, as I'm sure you know, there are in the overwhelming majority of cases, there is some sort of link between the victim and his or her murderer. And that makes it easier right. for detectives to narrow down the suspect pool. As detectives worked through this case, it became increasingly apparent that they were working what's known as a stranger murder. And that is a case in which someone unknown to the victims murders them. Stranger murders are notoriously difficult to solve, even in our current era of advanced forensic techniques, DNA, and so forth. It's still extremely difficult for detectives to work stranger murders and produce results in a timely manner. So in the course of investigating the Faria murders, the detectives started looking at whether or not a drifter along the highway near their home might have broken into the Husted home and murdered them on a whim. It's worth pointing out that the socioeconomic demographics of the Faria area are a little bit unusual and a little bit unique. I mentioned before that Faria Beach Colony is the gated neighborhood where the Husteds lived at the time of their murder. It's an extremely upscale community. The homes in there range in price, I would say, from probably the low millions to to maybe up to $10 million. But just outside Faria Beach Colony, outside this gated community, is Pacific Coast Highway. And there are big empty stretches of Pacific Coast Highway that run along the Pacific Coast. And people who live in RVs or vans or other vehicles that have been converted for nomadic living live along the coast during the year. It's a fairly popular thing to do. It's completely legal. And there are little RV lots along the coast as well that allow nomadic travelers with no connection to the local area to live there. So the fact that you had this large migratory population constantly moving through Faria just compounded the difficulties Ventura County Sheriff's detectives were already facing in trying to resolve this murder. They looked at whether or not anyone in an RV or anyone who was coming through the area temporarily might have been responsible for the murders. They couldn't make any progress in that direction. They looked, as I said before, into the backgrounds of Brock and Devine Husted. They couldn't find anything there. And as the days and weeks and months dragged on, the tension in the community and the frustration of the family members was just compounded.
Now tell us about things being compounded when Wendy DeRodio is killed in what some people thought might be similar circumstances in the same area, and this is in June. So tell us what happens with Wendy DeRodio.
So the Faria murders happen on May 20th, 2009, at sometime between 10 p.m. and 10:30 p.m. In the aftermath of the crime, like I said before, the community is completely on edge. There's a high degree of anxiety in the community. People are frightened. People are terrified. So in an attempt to assuage some of the community fear, the Ventura County Sheriff's Department organizes a community meeting at this fire station in Rincon Beach, which is just up the coast from Faria. It's just a few miles up the coast from Faria. At the firehouse community meeting, the sheriff's detectives tell the community members, "We're really sorry. We don't have any leads in the case. We can't tell you all that much about it because it's obviously an ongoing active investigation, and we don't want to divulge too many details lest we compromise the integrity of the investigation." But they said, "We don't have any reason to believe that anyone else is in danger. If you keep an eye out on your property, if you keep your doors locked, if you're aware of your surroundings, we believe that this was an isolated event. You have nothing to fear." Well, as you pointed out a moment ago, on June 3rd, 2009, just a couple of days after this firehouse community meeting takes place, Ventura County residents wake up to news that a woman named Wendy DeRodio, who was a 40-something-year-old licensed therapist and author, had been slaughtered by knife in her bedroom in Ventura Keys, which is exactly the same neighborhood where the Husteds lived. Now, as a really eerie coincidence, the DeRodio home was only about 50 yards as the crow flies from the former Husted residence. So, of course, this plunges the entire community back into a state of high anxiety. People are worried. And as I learned through sources in the course of my investigation, police were extremely worried at this time, too. Here they had two bedroom knife murders. They had no suspects. The police had reason to believe that the DeRodio murder was not connected to the Faria homicide. However, at the time, they couldn't go into a lot of details because neither case had been solved. They couldn't go into a lot of details about why they believed that was the case. So between the multiple violent crimes that had happened in this otherwise tranquil county and the lack of good information that was coming out of local law enforcement agencies, the community was really on edge. People were frightened. People were buying guns. People were buying burglar alarm systems. People were putting motion sensors on the lights around their homes. They were barricading themselves in at night. And that's quite a contrast from what Ventura County had experienced prior to that, where literally people in this world of worlds felt comfortable leaving their doors unlocked at night.
Now, so to compound again what's going on, we have a series of a bandit robbing people in the area, terrorizing the area, and you bring this and you tell this story because there's a description of the person doing these robberies. And tell us what that description is.
So after Wendy DeRodio was murdered on June 3rd, 2009, there appears to be no progress being made into the investigation of her murder. Her murder was investigated by the Ventura Police Department because she lived within the city limits of Ventura. The Ventura County Sheriff's Department, who was investigating the Husted homicide just a few miles up the coast, is making no progress with their case. So skip ahead a couple of months to September of 2009. Cashier working at a Shell gas station on Harbor Boulevard in the city of Ventura is manning his post. It's mid-evening, I would say probably around 8 or 9 o'clock at night. Out of nowhere, this robber barrels through the door, brandishing a black semi-automatic handgun, orders the gas station cashier to the floor, cleans out the register, and sprints back through the doors and disappears into the night. And over the coming weeks in September, this bandit strikes no less than four more times. He hits three more small businesses in Ventura. And he's finally suspected of committing another gas station robbery in the city in Santa Barbara County, just outside the Santa Barbara city limits. In all of the cases, the suspect in the robberies is described to detectives the same way. He's described as a white male, approximately 5'9", 5'10" in height, athletic build, wearing dark clothing, wearing gloves, usually wearing some kind of face covering, speaking in sort of an angry to monotone voice, brandishing a black handgun. These aren't highly sophisticated robberies. He's not able to access any of the safes in these businesses. He just cleans out the cash register, stuffs the money in his pocket, sprints through the doors. The Ventura Police Department, who has jurisdiction in all of the cases in their city, investigates the robberies thoroughly. They can't make any progress. Finally, on the evening of September 23rd, 2009, a gas station attendant is working in Santa Barbara County on State Street, which for people who are involved, who know the area at all, it's one of the main drags that runs north-south through the city of Santa Barbara. He's out on a relatively isolated stretch of North State Street, and just before he's ready to end his shift, a black-clad robber with a mask, with a bandana mask tied around his face, accosts him in the parking lot, accosts this gas station attendant in the parking lot, orders him back into the business, orders him to the floor, cleans out the cash register, and sprints from the business. It was ultimately that crime that ended up making progress in a lot of local investigations.
And at the time, too, they saw a Chevy Trailblazer, but the one thing that was interesting is it had no license plate.
Right. After the gas station attendant in Santa Barbara calls the sheriff's department, calls 911, there are customers pulling into the gas station to get fuel. And they notice a light-colored Chevy Trailblazer pulling out of the parking lot, turning west on State Street. And they notice that it doesn't have any license plates attached to it. And this is later confirmed when Santa Barbara County Sheriff's detectives go down to Ventura, and they're able to pull surveillance footage from an In-N-Out Burger in that city. It's worth noting that in the course of robbing the Santa Barbara gas station, the robber ended up stealing the gas station attendant's wallet. And then in the hours after the crime that night on September 23rd, 2009, the Santa Barbara gas station robber went to an In-N-Out Burger in the city of Ventura and used the gas station attendant's credit card to buy a meal. Well, as soon as that fact came to light, the Santa Barbara Sheriff's Department, who were investigating the robbery, went down to Ventura. They pulled the surveillance tapes, and they noticed that the Chevy Trailblazer indeed did not have any license plates affixed to its front or rear bumpers.
Now, they just, as you say in the book, they still hit a dead end despite these sort of leads. They still hit a dead end in both of these murders, or all of these murders, don't they?
That's exactly right.
Now let's talk about, introduce Josh Packer. Talk about Randy Packer. We won't talk about the whole incredible tragedy that was Josh's life, but let's talk about some of the beginning of it with his father, Randy Packer, and his mother, Terry Williamson. And this is a person that you interviewed at length, and the access that you have and provide in this book is incredible. So tell us about Terry Williamson and Jack Packer and basically Josh Packer's early life and his not-so-auspicious beginnings.
Right. So as you pointed out a second ago, the Ventura County Sheriff's Department is completely baffled by the Faria murders in late 2009. The Ventura Police Department, the homicide unit, is completely baffled as to Wendy DeRodio's murder in the fall of 2009. The Santa Barbara County Sheriff's Department and the robbery detail of the Ventura PD are completely at a loss as to who their serial robber is, who's been robbing all of these small businesses. But they do have one clue, in addition to the eyewitnesses who had seen the robber in his disguise. They know that the suspect was driving this light-colored Chevy Trailblazer that didn't have any license plates attached to it. So one night, as these two Ventura police officers are patrolling their beat, they notice this Trailblazer literally blazing along one of the streets in Ventura. So they decide to execute a vehicle stop and pull it over. And as they're pulling the vehicle over, one of the officers remembers an attempt to identify poster, which, for those who may not know, an attempt to identify poster is a poster that's compiled by one law enforcement agency who's seeking an outstanding suspect, and it's disseminated to other law enforcement agencies throughout the state. And the hope is that by broadcasting this attempt to identify poster far and wide, another officer, another member of the law enforcement community will recognize something about the suspect and be able to provide a tip that will ultimately lead to the apprehension of that suspect. So these two Ventura police officers, after they've stopped the Chevy Trailblazer, they remember this attempt to identify poster that had been sent down a couple of days earlier by the Santa Barbara County Sheriff's Department. And in that attempt to identify poster, the Santa Barbara detectives indicated that they were looking for a white male suspect who was driving a Chevy Trailblazer. Now, when the Ventura PD officers stop the speeding Trailblazer, they notice that it does have license plates affixed to its bumpers, so it's in compliance in that regard. But when they get up to the window, they look down at the driver and they notice that he is a young white male, He has kind of a stocky build. He's about 5 feet eight, 5 feet 9 inches tall. And in fact, he had been a former football star for the Ventura High School Cougars football team just a couple of years earlier. When they grab his driver's license and they run it, they can't find any outstanding warrants on him. But they do make note of the fact that he had turned 20 years old just a couple of days prior to the stop. So doing their due diligence, the officers, after they write a citation for the speeding driver and turn him loose, they contact the Santa Barbara County Sheriff's Department and they say, listen, this may be nothing, but we pulled over a guy a couple of days ago for speeding down here. He drives Trailblazer, and he's known as kind of a local ruffian. He's had some brushes with the law, nothing extremely serious, but we just wanted to pass this along to you to see if it might aid you in your robbery investigation. Santa Barbara County detectives say thank you, and they do begin investigating the driver. Now, the driver's name is Joshua Graham Packer. And as you mentioned a second ago, his beginnings were extremely inauspicious, to say the least. His parents met in a psychiatric hospital when they were teenagers. They both grew up in the Cincinnati, Ohio area. And both of his parents were committed for one reason or another to a Cincinnati psychiatric hospital. His mother was 15 at the time. His father was 17, and they were both locked up for, I think his father was in for schizophrenia treatment. His mother was in because she just couldn't get along at home with her father and stepmother. So eventually, after a long series of events that I lay out in very meticulous detail in the book, his mother and father decide to get married. His mother was in a very abusive situation prior to that. His father, I suppose, needed someone to help give his life some ballast. And so in an attempt to provide some stability for each other, his mother, Terry Williamson, and Josh Packer's father, Randy Packer, decide to get married. Terry Williamson married Randy Packer 2 days after her 17th birthday. And as she explained to me during our many, many, many hours of interviews, she was actually married with bruises on her wrist. She told me that Randy Packer was very abusive to her. So anyway, to make a long story short, eventually the Packers decide to leave Cincinnati. Both of them had many bad memories there. By this time, they have a baby, Josh's older sister, Shauna, and they decide, like so many people before them, to seek their manifest destiny out here on the West Coast. So they pack up their aging car, they bundle up their baby, they get on the freeway, and they start making their way west. And about 3 weeks later, they end up in Ventura, completely random. They had no intention of ever visiting Ventura. They didn't know anything about the place, but that's where their car broke down. So they were taken into a homeless shelter along with their daughter, Shauna. And from there, they began to build a life for themselves in the city of Ventura. And that was where Josh Packer was born on September, in September of 1989. And that was ultimately where he was identified as a suspect in the Santa Barbara County robbery 20 years later.
Now, part of his life is characterized by what happens with his mother, and his mother is a crack addict and methamphetamine addict and can't take care of him at different times. She foolishly meets people like Robert Miller, who claimed to want to mentor Josh. Again, we can't go into all of it, but suffice to say that there are major incidents that I don't care. I'm very skeptical when I hear some of the reported abuse from some of these people at trial. But in this particular case, based on your research, these are some incidents that you can't put aside and not factor in to the bigger picture. So tell us some of the major incidents that must have had something to do with shaping this guy's psyche.
I couldn't agree with you more, Dan. When I hear so many of these psychopaths in court attempting to excuse their homicidal behavior through childhood sob stories, I'm always repulsed by it. But as you pointed out a second ago, in this case, these events are well documented, and they really do suggest that Josh Packer was on a one-way track to oblivion from a very young age. When Josh was still just a toddler, his parents broke up. By the time Josh was 5 years old, his parents had completely divorced. His father had abandoned the family in Ventura, and Randy Packer had moved back to the Cincinnati area. At the same time, his mother is becoming deeply involved in the local drug culture of Ventura. She, as you pointed out a second ago, she got hooked on methamphetamine. She was absent for much of Josh's young life. So Josh was growing up around very disreputable characters in the Ventura area. And in the course of growing up around drugs and crime and criminals and degenerates in the seedier areas of Ventura, Josh Packer came into contact with hardcore sex offenders. And just to give your listeners a thumbnail sketch of some of the things he experienced as a young child, I remember when I was talking to Terry one night, one of the more chilling incidents she described to me was the first time she tried crystal meth. At the time, she, Shauna, and Josh were living with this hardcore drug addict criminal at a small motel in Ventura. Terry said that as soon as the crystal meth, which was injected into her arm, as soon as it hit her system, she said she felt her brain just explode with this electric current like she'd never experienced before. And she said that she basically locked the kids in the little kitchenette they had in this hotel room. And then she and this degenerate with whom she was living at the time, just using her own words, quote unquote, just had sex for days. And of course, at the time, Josh and Shauna are about 6 or 7 years old. They get hungry. So these small children have to climb out the window of the motel and go to an old woman's home who's in the neighborhood. And the old woman would feed the children. She would play with them. She'd look after them. But her son, this old woman whom Josh and Shauna Packer would seek out in order to have their basic needs met, she was being looked after by her son, who was in his 60s at the time. Well, as it turns out, he ended up sexually assaulting Josh Packer when he was about 6 years old, 6 or 7 years old. And obviously that set Josh on a very bad course. Now, added to this, Terry becomes absent not long after it. Josh is sent to live with one of Terry's former husbands, who assumes custody of Josh and Shauna. I lay out in the book exactly what occurred with him, which was no picnic for Josh. A lot more abuse, a lot more exposure to criminals, disfiguring injuries that he suffered in the quote-unquote care of this former husband of Terry's. And finally, Terry does get off drugs. Terry told me that she used drugs consistently for about 3 years. She was largely absent from Josh's life during that period of time. But finally, in 1998, Terry is able to pull her life together. Terry saw someone murdered right in front of her. Terry's explanation of that to me was absolutely chilling. But she said that it did compel her to get off drugs. So Terry gets off drugs in 1998. She goes back to her children in Ventura. And not long after she moves back in with her children and her former husband, Josh is attacked in his bedroom by a wanted sex offender. Which is just another surreal aside. Here is a child who has already been sexually molested on multiple occasions. He suffered disfiguring injuries on multiple occasions. And then he's attacked in his own bed at the age of, I think it was 10 or 11 years old at the time. The suspect in that case was finally caught after he tried to break into another home on a different night, but the damage had been done. And one of the things I was able to get access to in this case, which was enormously helpful in terms of compiling a comprehensive portrait of Josh Packer, was I was able to get access to his full permanent record from the Ventura Unified School District. And it's so obvious. I mean, Josh's school record is almost a perfect mirror of the traumas he was experiencing at home during childhood. There were no severe behavioral issues, even during the time when, Terry was still marginally involved with her son's life. But after Josh was attacked in that bedroom, he began to exhibit really, really violent tendencies at school. When he was in fifth grade, he was suspended for stabbing another child in the neck with a pencil. Throughout middle school, Josh had a lot of problems, and those problems actually ended up persisting into high school. Now, you mentioned the character whom I identify in the book as Robert Miller. That's not the man's real name, but that is the name right. I use for him in the book. Robert Miller was a youth worker in Ventura. He worked with the Boys and Girls Club of Ventura. So after Terry re-entered Josh's life in 1998, Josh started spending time at the Ventura Boys and Girls Club. Well, this man, Robert Miller, approaches Terry and he says, listen, I've been getting to know Josh throughout the time. He's been here at the Boys and Girls Club. It would really be my honor to serve as Josh's mentor. Now, here's Terry at the time. She's trying to recover from her narcotics addiction. She's trying to surmount, at least in some way, the terrible decisions she'd been making for several years up to that point. She has no education. She's on welfare. She's living in a very unstable situation. She has these two young children. Terry, in her own words, as she explained to me, said that Miller's offer of assistance seemed like an absolute godsend. You know, here was an upstanding member of the community, a college graduate. She was blown away by his offer of assistance. And in fact, during his middle school and early high school years, Josh went and lived with Miller for a while. And as I explain in the book, there is extremely compelling evidence that Miller was less than less than savory, less than positive influence on Josh's life.
You also talk about an injury, a head injury, and again, we talk about some things that might contribute to someone's behavior. Tell us a little bit about this head injury.
So when Josh was about 8 years old, he was living with Terry's former husband in a converted garage in Ventura. And this converted garage had a wooden loft that was elevated about 20 feet above a hard concrete floor. So one night, Josh is sleeping on the floor of this elevated loft, again, Terry is off using drugs, running with this wild criminal crowd. Her former husband is looking out for Josh's best interest, supposedly. As Josh is tossing and turning up there, he rolls to the edge of this loft and then tumbles more than 20 feet to the floor below. When he lands on the floor, he ends up cracking his skull open. And so the stepfather immediately bundles Josh up and rushes him to the emergency room at Ventura County Medical Center. Well, Josh actually experienced not only a fractured skull, but a very, very severe concussion during the fall. And his stepfather was encouraged to bring Josh back for aftercare. Now, according to Terry, that aftercare never occurred. Josh was never given any further treatment after that one examination at the medical center. And that is a very compelling detail of this story. I mean, we never know exactly why criminals commit offenses they do. I think we can probably agree that crimes happen for a large number of reasons. But, sure. Some of the research that's been done by people like Jonathan Pincus wrote the book Base Instincts, an absolutely fabulous read. John Pincus is the head of neurology at the VA hospital in Washington, D.C. He's a professor of neurology at Georgetown University Med School. Pincus's research suggests in no uncertain terms that there is a causal link between childhood head injuries and violent behavior later in life. So in the course of reading about Josh Packer, it's worth keeping in mind that he did experience an extremely serious head injury after falling from that converted garage loft.
And as you explained too, I do believe that there's such a thing as a confluence of influences, so many things in conjunction, and who knows how much they factor, but in this deadly combination, we'll say. You do have some incredible stories about how Josh seems to have it all together despite this incredibly dysfunctional life, but then he's a football player, he excels in athletics. There are some attributes that he has that are to his benefit, but then everything falls apart. and you talk about a girlfriend named Jennifer, and when he tries to break off this relationship, or she tries to break off the relationship, and his experimentation with fentanyl. So tell us a little bit about this story, and because it's very demonstrative of many things.
It definitely is. So as I mentioned a moment ago, Josh had extreme behavioral problems all the way through middle school. Finally, he ends up at Ventura High School, and he's not an outstanding student. Josh Packer is not an unintelligent person. Based on everything I've seen, he possesses at least average to slightly above average intelligence, at the very least. But when he goes to Ventura High School, he's not much of an academic. He's interested in athletics, and that's fortunate for him because he is an outstanding athlete. Everyone with whom I spoke described Josh as perhaps one of the best athletes they've ever had in that area. He was a terrific varsity wrestler. He made the varsity wrestling team his freshman year. He also made the varsity football team his freshman year. And I have to say that in looking at his life in total, Josh Packer's ability to overcome his childhood traumas in high school was very, very impressive. And to his credit, he did take what appear to be very substantive steps to try and come to terms with some of his demons. For example, during high school, Josh became involved in this Christian youth group called Young Life. And it appears that he flourished in that group. He never had any behavioral problems. He never had any violent outbursts. He really tended to study scripture very heavily. And then, of course, when he would go to school, he would, be involved with the football team, the wrestling team, his classes. He was never an extraordinary student, but he did do well enough to get by in his classes and maintain his eligibility for athletics. Well, like you said, that all came to a very tragic end during Josh's senior year of high school. Like most students, Josh was, during his senior year, he was looking toward college. He wanted to try and get an athletic scholarship to attend college to try and apparently better his life. But Josh made a very, very bad decision during his senior year. So during his senior year, Josh is working as a TA for one of the coaches at the school. And on the way to his TA assignment, his teacher's assistant assignment that day, Josh is approached in the hallways of Ventura High School by one of his friends. And the friend says, "Hey, listen, I have this new drug. You want to give it a shot?" or something to that effect. And Josh asks what it is. And the friend explains it's a time-release narcotics patch that's given to cancer patients to help control their pain. Well, as it turns out, it was a drug called fentanyl. For those who don't know, fentanyl is about 100 times more potent than heroin. It's sort of a pharmaceutical grade synthetic opiate that's used to treat severe pain in cancer patients. Well, when Josh is offered this drug fentanyl, he thinks nothing of it. I mean, there's a little bit of evidence to suggest that Josh might have been experimenting with drugs prior to that. Anyway, he takes this fentanyl patch from his friend. He pops it in his mouth. He chews it up. He sucks down the medication, spits out the patch, and then walks to his TA assignment. Well, when he gets to that TA assignment, he can barely stand up. Time has slowed down. The walls are blurring. The room is dissolving around him. So Josh asks his teacher, "Listen, can I go to the back of the room and just put my head down for a couple of minutes? I'm not really feeling very well." So the teacher, obviously who's preoccupied with teaching the class and doing other things, says, "Yeah, no problem." So Josh staggers to the back of the room, takes a seat, puts his head down. And several minutes later, the teacher goes to check on Josh. Well, as I explain in the book, Josh has stopped breathing. He's overdosed on fentanyl in the classroom at Ventura High. And paramedics are called. They rush him to the hospital. Josh is a young, strong, healthy athlete. So he's able to make a full recovery in terms of his physical health. Unfortunately, in terms of his status at Ventura High School, Josh's days were done. He was immediately ousted from the football team. And I think as the school gave more and more thought to the ignominious circumstances of Josh's overdose, he was asked to leave school, and he was asked to finish his high school graduation credits at a local adult learning center. So here in one fell swoop, Josh has lost the social network that he was part of. He was a very popular student, according to what I've been told at Ventura High School. he was known to have a volatile personality, but again, that was sort of aligned with his public persona as an athlete and as a sort of jock. And Josh has also lost his eligibility for getting a college scholarship. Josh's grades aren't good enough to get an academic scholarship to college. Now he's been kicked off the team. He's been asked to leave school. He's in an adult learning center. And Josh's horizons have just narrowed significantly.
What's his relationship with Jennifer characterized, especially when she rebuffs him?
Right. So around this same time, and I do use a pseudonym for the girl in the book, Josh has a main squeeze, and she is the daughter of a local law enforcement sergeant, a very good guy from everything I've been able to gather. And that, in fact, is the reason I changed the name of the book, was to help protect him. She is an extremely attractive girl, very, very good looking, and apparently Josh is head over heels about her. They dated for several years. She's 2 years older than he is, and she lives in a really affluent section on the east side of Ventura. When I first visited that neighborhood just to check out where she lived, I noticed that, not only was her house one of the nicest on the street, her lawn was by far the greenest in the neighborhood. And I thought that was sort of a perfect metaphor for how he must have viewed her. You know, she stood out even from all of the splendor around her. Apparently she really stood out to Josh. So anyway, after they begin dating, Josh immediately becomes very protective. Every time another guy will come up and talk to this girl, Josh will attack him, often physically. Also, around the same time, this girl's parents begin to notice that Josh is sitting outside their home or just down the street from their home in his car watching their house, or he appears to be watching their house. He just sits there for hours on end and stares. And apparently, the parents didn't quite know how to broach that subject with Josh. From everything I've been told, they didn't have any major problems with him. But finally, at the end of the day, this girl decides that she and Josh need a little time apart. And according to what's on the permanent record here, when that happened, Josh threatened suicide. He threatened to kill himself. He threatened to overdose on pills. And the girl was taken aback. She didn't know quite what to do. She was like a lot of women are when they're trapped in situations like that, where their significant other is threatening to harm himself, yet she wants to break off the relationship because he's becoming overly possessive. She didn't know quite how to handle it. So they did break off their relationship. They did start to take a little bit of space from each other, but they did remain in slight contact with one another.
One of the most interesting things is that she gave him two and very important parting gifts. Tell us what those two very important and cherished parting gifts were to him from her.
So after high school, Josh takes a job at a business called Baxter Pharmaceuticals. He's working as a security guard. And with his college dreams crushed, Josh is thinking about potentially entering the Marine Corps. He had expressed an interest in the military. Well, after he and this girl had broken up in high school, she decided to stay in Ventura after graduating from high school as well. So they start to revive their relationship. Well, eventually they move into an apartment with Josh's old quote-unquote mentor from the Boys and Girls Club of Ventura, Robert Miller. So here is this 40-something-year-old man living in an apartment with, you know, two kids, one of whom is 19 years old, Josh, and then his girlfriend is 21 years old. I'm sure it probably sounded like a good idea at the time for these three people to live together in a two-bedroom apartment in Ventura and split costs. But, you know, I think as most of us have realized over the years, roommate situations don't always work out as we would envision them. And so after about 6 weeks of living together, the girlfriend is ready to bail. They moved into the apartment together over there on the east side of Ventura in mid-March of 2009. By April of 2009, the girlfriend is ready to take off. But in an attempt to calm some of Josh's aggress surrounding her decision to leave, she decides to buy him two parting gifts. One was a motorcycle. The other was a black motorcycle helmet. And according to all of the witness statements that I was given access to in the course of my research, Josh was extremely disturbed by this girl's decision to leave him. He wanted them to remain together. He had very intense feelings for her. They'd been through a lot of things together. And she was frightened, according to other statements I've been given. Now, these were statements that were given directly to law enforcement, and I read them in the course of reports, so I tend to think that they're very, very accurate. But before she left him, she gave him this this motorcycle and this helmet. And in the weeks after she left, Josh's situation really started to go downhill. She left in April 2009. By the end of April, in late April 2009, Josh was implicated. He was positively ID'd as the suspect in a Ventura street robbery. And then, of course, after that.
Tell us how, fast forward to how we talked about the original DNA sample. There was a DNA sample under the fingernails, and we talked about on the hand towel, and it was blood droplets. And there's and you talk about very, very much, and we'll touch on this too, about a very important part of your book is talking about DNA and DNA legislation potentially, and then the science of DNA and its advances. So tell us about how he is finally linked through DNA, and tell us the process and the turn of events that happen that finally get him to be the suspect, and tell us about the whole process.
So I mentioned earlier about the two Ventura patrol officers who pulled over the speeding trailblazer on September 30th, 2009. They saw that Josh Packer was the driver. They thought that he matched the suspect description from the Santa Barbara gas station robbery. They knew that his vehicle matched the description of the vehicle seen at the crime at the robbery scene. So they turn his name over to Santa Barbara County robbery detectives. Well, those detectives begin looking at a couple of very compelling clues. I mentioned earlier that in the course of the Santa Barbara robbery, the robber stole both the gas station attendant's wallet, and I may or may not have mentioned that he stole the gas station attendant's cell phone as well. In the hours after the gas station robbery, the robber called one of the gas station attendant's friends and threatened him about contacting police. Well, to make a long story short, after the Ventura patrol officers forwarded Josh Packer's name to the Santa Barbara County detectives, the detectives in Santa Barbara County started looking at phone number at where the phone calls had originated that had gone to the gas station attendant's friend. Well, those phone calls originated in Josh Packer's neighborhood in Ventura. So here, Josh Packer matches the physical description of the physical description of the Santa Barbara County robber. He drives the exact same type of vehicle. And now the victim's phone has been used in Josh Packer's neighborhood. So the list of suspects is narrowing in that Santa Barbara case, and detectives are looking at Josh more and more carefully. Well, as they're looking at Josh more carefully, a couple of other very compelling pieces of evidence come to light. It turns out that Josh was in a habit in September of 2009 of going to the Chumash Casino, which is a huge Native American casino in Santa Barbara County. Josh liked to gamble up there. So the detectives in Santa Barbara started looking at Josh's gaming activity at the Chumash Casino around the time of the gas station robbery. And what they ultimately found was that Josh lost $268, I believe, on the night of the gas station robbery. The detectives were also able to pull surveillance footage from September 23rd, 2009, which was the night of the gas station robbery, and they were able to tell that Josh Packer's Trailblazer didn't have any license plates on it that night. Finally, the detectives were able to trace Josh's personal cell phone to within just a couple of blocks of that State Street gas station in Santa Barbara around the time of the robbery. And so with all of that circumstantial evidence in place, detectives were finally able in early 2010, in January 2010, to arrest Josh for the Santa Barbara County gas station robbery. So they went down to Ventura. They went to Terry Williamson's home, which at the time was on Ocean Avenue in Ventura. They arrested Josh and they transported him up the coast to Santa Barbara County and booked him into the county jail. And I should point out that at the time, a new California law had just gone into effect in January of 2009. that mandated the extraction and cataloging of all felony arrestees in our state. So the net effect of that was when Josh was arrested for the Santa Barbara County robbery and driven up to the Santa Barbara County jail to be booked, he had his mugshot taken, he had his fingerprints taken, he had all of his vital information recorded, and most importantly, he had a buccal swab, which is like a large Q-tip, taken from his mouth. So the law enforcement officer would just stick this Q-tip inside Josh's mouth, scrape some cheek cells, and then the officer throws it into a bag. That bag is sent to the California Department of Justice in Richmond. And then Josh's full DNA profile was developed. It was amplified. It was developed. And it was entered into the system. And 3 months later, as Josh is awaiting trial on his Santa Barbara County robbery charge, that's when the hit is made in CODIS. And that is when Josh is finally linked to the Faria homicide, which had happened in May of 2009.
Now, from there, again, we've only got about 9 minutes, so we won't be able to go into the rest of this incredible story because that concerns the trial. But suffice to say that this is a death penalty case potentially, and he has lawyers that are basically their role is to save his life. Part of that is obviously to be able to have mitigating factors that would prevent somebody from being put to death. We talked a lot about, about him being a victim in his early life and that contributing to this homicidal rage. But with this non-death penalty and with this fight to not have the death penalty, there is a reason to not have a trial. And tell us about the fight of his attorneys to not have a death penalty and what is the alternative if they don't have a death penalty. And tell us a little bit about that fight by his lawyers.
Sure. Well, the Ventura County District Attorney's Office, as soon as Josh Packer was identified as the suspect in the Faria homicide, he was arrested and taken into custody, and his case was forwarded to the Ventura County DA's office. Because of the sensational, gruesome nature of the case, because the Faria homicide had struck such fear in the community, the DA's office was steadfast in pursuing the death penalty against Josh Packer. Now, of course, the DA's office had him dead to rights. I was able to meet with the chief deputy prosecutor of Ventura County, Mike Frawley, who handled the case. I was actually able to meet with him just after Packer's sentencing. But, he was of the belief that there was only one appropriate sanction for this horrible murder that Josh had committed. Josh's defense attorneys, I think, although I was not able to interview them in the course of preparing the book, I think they recognized very reasonably that the state had Josh dead to rights. Josh's DNA was all over the crime scene. Josh, there were a million inculpatory pieces of evidence that link Josh in no uncertain terms to the crime scene. And I won't enumerate those now. I'll leave those for your readers, your listeners to read on their own. But suffice it to say that Josh's defense team recognized that he would be convicted if he went to trial and that he would be given the death penalty if he were convicted. So eventually they were able to appeal a motion they had filed to have Mike Frawley removed from the case. That the appeal of that motion went all the way to the California Supreme Court. And finally, at the end of the day, when both sides were getting ready to have an evidentiary hearing on Mike Frawley's fitness to serve as the prosecutor in the case, the district attorney's office agreed to a plea bargain. And that plea bargain allowed Josh to avoid the death penalty and receive a sentence of life without parole for the Husted murders. And so that's where Josh is now. He was originally sent to Wasco State Prison's reception area, and now he is at the California Medical Center in Stockton.
Now, you talk about reaching out to him for an interview and not getting a response, but the interview, the key interview that you did get was with Terry Williams and his mother. Tell our audience what she had to say about her culpability and overall just her take on this incredible case that her son and ultimately she was involved with.
I am a major fan of true crime, and I would say if there's one aspect of Black Knight Gold Coast that distinguishes it from virtually any other work of true crime I've ever read, it's the perspective I'm able to give readers on how the offender's family feels after their relative has been taken into custody for a high-profile, notorious, violent crime. I think we're in the habit, as we should be, of identifying with the victims' families, the victims themselves, and that should be done. However, I contacted Josh for an interview after he was sent to Wasco State Prison. He never got back to me, as I came to find out later. He was really traumatized. He's been struggling with a lot of mental health issues since he was arrested for the Faria murders. But I was able to make contact and actually strike up a friendship of sorts with his mother, whom I actually came to admire in kind of a strange way. Like I pointed out earlier, she, by her own admission, made a million and one mistakes when Josh was growing up. She abandoned him. She allowed him to be abused. She provided unsavory individuals access to him and so forth. But she's really done an amazing job of pulling her life together. So in the course of interviewing her for what must have been dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of hours, it was interesting to see what her perspective was on having her son arrested, jailed, facing a possible death sentence for these crimes, and how tragic it was that because Josh was 18 at the time he was arrested for the Faria murders, his mother was not able to ask his attorneys for any information about the case. She was not able to ask Josh for any information about the case because Josh was being held at the Ventura County Jail. He was in solitary confinement. Obviously, Terry, over the phones between the plexiglass and the jail, she didn't want to ask her son any information about his case. So she really had absolutely no insight into these crimes whatsoever. All she knew is that her son was facing a death penalty, There was extremely compelling evidence against him. And that's where I entered the picture. When I started interviewing her, I let her know that in the course of my research, I had obtained access to a huge amount of information on the case, reports, police reports, crime scene photos, everything pretty much. And so I forwarded those to her and really talking those through with her and getting her reaction to those and to her son's predicament in general, without a doubt, one of the most memorable experiences of my life. And that's what I try to bring to life for readers in Black Knight Gold Coast.
Wanted to say, too, that what we haven't spoken about, and we can talk about this briefly, is that they avoided a death penalty trial, and they also avoided having a 9-year-old, still a child, having to testify at court, being further traumatized. But what did happen with, and what is the state, as far as you know, of the 9-year-old and the 11-year-old that will be ever fairly scarred for life from what they saw and what they experienced? We haven't spoken about their welfare. What has happened to the two children?
I don't know specifics. I should be honest about that right up the bat. But what I can say is this. The run-up to Josh Packer's trial lasted for several years. The murders happened in 2009. He was arrested in the spring of 2010. He finally pled guilty in December 2014, and he was actually sentenced almost exactly a year ago. He was sentenced to life without parole on February 6th, 2015. In the years since the murders, Isabella and Brocky have grown into teenagers. I know that they were, the last I heard, they were living with family members in the Moorpark area. And I can only hope and I can only pray that they are living slightly well-adjusted lives. I think the fact that they had such loving, conscientious, stable family members probably gave them a very good shot at leading normal lives after this horrible tragedy they experienced as children.
You talked about one word trying to encompass all the experience that you had in researching this book, and I've spoken to other true crime authors. It takes a toll to get this close to the flame, to get this close to people, and then have to report on such a tragedy. What's that one word that you did use, and explain what you mean by that one word sort of encompassing your experience?
Sure. I tried to find a word that sort of summed up the really toxic breadth of the Feria case, and the word I finally settled on was paradox. And the reason I settled on paradox is the whole case really in so many ways is a contradiction. Brock and Davina Husted were very affluent people. They were people living the American dream. They were people who had it all. And I think because they were so safe and they were so secure and they were so comfortable in their daily lives, that contributed to them to letting their guard down for just a moment. And when they let their guard down, of course, that's when Josh Packer struck. And that's when he claimed their lives and forever altered their lives and the lives of their children. So in that sense, the fact that comfort and safety actually contributed to a relaxing of safety conscientiousness, that is a tremendous paradox. It's also a real paradox in my mind that, you know, California taxpayers are now saddled with keeping Josh Packer in prison for the rest of his life. It's not as expensive to keep an inmate in regular prison as it is to execute a prisoner and send him through his entire appellate process, but it's still very expensive. And it's really paradoxical to me, at least, that California taxpayers will spend $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year to keep Josh Packer in state prison. Yet when he was a child, there wasn't one dime invested in finding out what his mental health issues were, helping him overcome the what we can only assume was malignant trauma of being molested and abused on so many occasions, of the head injuries, of the neglect, of the abandonment, and so forth. Josh's entire school record, there's not one indication that he was ever given any sort of substantive psychological counseling. So I find it paradoxical that we'll spend all this money on him now that he's an adult who's committed heinous murders, but we as a society wouldn't spend anything on this kid when he was so young. And I think ultimately, the greatest paradox of the Ventura tragedy is that, you know, this is a case that has devastated so many families. This is a case that devastated the DeBoney family, the Husted family, Josh's family. But at the same time, this case points out why arrestee DNA collection is so important. There is not a doubt in my mind that if Josh Packer had been left on the streets, if he had never been identified as a suspect in this case, he would have claimed other lives. It might not have been 2 years from now. It might not have been 3 years from now, but it would have happened again. And by collecting his DNA at the time of his arrest on that Santa Barbara robbery case, we were able to prevent that from happening. So the paradox there is, a case that has been so deeply traumatizing to so many families can actually spare more families pain by putting reasonable DNA, arrestee DNA collection laws on the books. That's not an uncontroversial position. I have come under some fire for taking that position, but based on the totality of my research, based on all the work I did on this book, I have to say that it's bordering on negligence for any law enforcement jurisdiction in the United States, Canada, or any other country that has a modern law enforcement apparatus not to take arrestee DNA at the time of booking.
Yes, and you cite another really dramatic example with the Green River Killer, that you show that if DNA testing were mandatory, as you suggest, that maybe 60 women could have been spared. I did take a lie detector test. He was cleared as a suspect. So you do put a big practical what if, and to demonstrate, again, what could have been.
I think your listeners should keep in mind, too, that 2 weeks after Josh Packer pled guilty to the Feria murders, the first appellate district of the California Court of Appeals ruled on a case called People versus Buza. And in that case, this man, this convicted arsonist named Mark Buza, had challenged the statute that actually allowed law enforcement agencies to collect arrestee collect DNA from felony arrestees. So the bottom line there is, if Josh Packer was arrested in California today for the Santa Barbara robbery, his DNA would not be collected. It would not be sent to CODIS, and it would not be linked to the Feria murders. He'd still be out walking the streets. That idea is something that should resonate very strongly with all of us.
Absolutely. I think it's a very, very important part of your book. You you make a great argument for this, and I think it's an important component of your book, and I'm glad that we could speak about it, because I think it's very, very important. Being DNA has been a fantastic boom for law enforcement like no other, and especially in light of all the discreditation of things that we thought were really consistent and worthwhile at court and trial. So DNA has very little controversy except in the area that you're bringing up in this book in terms of when it can be collected and why, and what is the trade-off in terms of people's privacy. But you make a great argument for the necessity and the importance of DNA collection. So I want to congratulate you on that. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Black Knight Gold Coast. For those that may want to contact you or keep in touch, do you have a website, Facebook? How can people contact you if so desired?
I don't have a website or Facebook, but if people want to contact me, they can send me an email. My email address is gray, G-R-A-Y, .calent, C-A-L-E-N-T, @gmail.com. And also, if anyone's interested in seeing actual video footage of Josh Packer in the Ventura County Jail, you can also check out my YouTube page. I sent you the link, Dan. I have video footage of Josh Packer brawling with 8 deputies during his confinement in the Ventura County Jail. So all you should do is go to YouTube, and you can either enter my name, or you can enter inmate brawls with deputies or fights with deputies or something to that effect, and that video should come up.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Again, thank you very much for coming on, talking about Black Knight, Gold Coast, a fascinating story. Thank you very much, Gray George. Have a great night.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me. Have a great night.
You too. Good night.
Good night.